Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. It's fall, and the farmers markets are filling with local apples from across our region. So today we'll be checking in with apple farmers.
This is like the best part of doing what we do is because we get to climb in trees for like, I climb in trees for a living almost.
And cider makers.
Where I grew up in Highland, Virginia, just about everybody had a cider barrel in their cellar. And so I grew up making anywhere between 5 and 8 barrels a year.
And we'll find out how apple pie helps to bring people together. Well, any pie, really.
Pie also demands you to sit down with other people. It's not like a cupcake that is your personal party. It is a communal dish. So you have to sit down to eat it. It's not something you can eat on the go. It's best shared, people sitting around it.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Here in Appalachia, it's apple season, and that means apple growers are sending this year's crop to farmers markets and grocery stores. But the majority of the apples grown here get sent to manufacturers to be used in applesauce and apple juice. By the way, did you know that Golden Delicious apples originated right here in West Virginia? In fact, they're our state fruit. Apples have been a major agricultural industry for the Mountain State, but according to the Department of Agriculture, the apple industry has decreased in West Virginia since 2010. In particular, the Eastern Panhandle, the land that was used to grow apples, is experiencing a real estate boom. So in the last few years, more and more farmers have been selling their land and getting out of the farming industry. So in honor of apple season, we're going to listen back to an episode that originally aired last September, celebrating Appalachia. One glimmer of hope for the industry may be hard apple cider. Once nearly forgotten because of prohibition, the adult beverage is enjoying a comeback. Some of the apples grown in Monroe County, West Virginia, are being used in a cidery that opened a few years ago in Lewisburg. Roxy Todd visited Hawk Knob Cider 2 years ago as they were celebrating their opening day. The owners started making cider together as a hobby 10 years ago when they were at West Virginia University.
When I pull into Hawk Knob Cidery, I pass dozens of sheep grazing in the fields. I park next to a truck loaded with empty wooden apple crates from a nearby farm. Apples that must have been juiced and brewed into cider and mead. All those wooden apple crates tell me I've made it to the right farm.
Well, here we are in the Greenbrier Valley. We're at the base of Muddy Creek Mountain. It's a pretty wide valley for West Virginia, and it has these gentle rolling slopes, which, to me has always spoken to me, and it just feels really good here. It's a wonderful place for, fruit trees, apples in particular. I'm Will Lewis. I'm a co-owner of Hawk Knob Hard Cider and Mead.
I'm Josh Bennett, co-owner of Hawk Knob Hard Cider and Mead. This is really, it's a real dream. I know that sounds like a cliche, but we've just really, this has been a real deep passion and dream of ours ever since starting brewing mead together in cider back in college.
So I started making mead, and that really piqued Josh's interest too, because he's been making cider, growing up his life.
Yeah, I had grown up making hard cider. Where I grew up in Highland, Virginia, which borders Pendleton and Pocahontas, just about everybody had a cider barrel in their cellar. And so I grew up making anywhere between 5 and 8 barrels a year. So that was pretty traditional. And then when we started making mead together, we started making cider and mead in college, and I think we were already dreaming of doing this commercially from that time.
I'm Haley McIntosh. And this is?
I'm Trevor McIntosh.
And we are here at Hawk Knob trying some cider today.
Well, might as well, you want to get a little tour of the facility? You've already had it.
Yeah, sure.
The vats over here on the left is where we do most of the primary fermentation at. That's also how we carbonate the cider at the end of the process.
Well, let's try some cider.
So this is really what I grew up making, and I just still can't get away from drawing cider right out of the barrel, because it's working through its process. It's still fermenting. The cider's still got a lot of floral stuff coming out in it. You're getting kind of the freshness of the barrel at the same time. It's pretty exciting when you drink a raw cider that's still working right out of the barrel. And in our traditional cider, we've really tried to kind of replicate the sort of effervescence that you have in a cider that you pull out of the barrel. We've kind of really got the most minimal amount of carbonation in that style, in the traditional hard cider, to replicate this, what's coming right out of the barrel.
It smells really good. I really like this.
So, this is mead. Have you ever had mead before? So this, you're going to taste all of the different characteristics that you would expect from the apples, but then you're also getting all the characteristics of the honey. And
oh, I definitely taste the honey.
So
that's what
honey,
that is.
If you think about
you
it.
You taste the honey? It lingers on, too. Yeah. Like, I still taste it.
We don't like drinking sweet stuff, so we make dry mead and dry cider. And our meads, we feel, we age them, we oak age them, and they're really dry and complex, and we feel they could even stand up to other types of table wine, like Chardonnays, or even the red fruits could be compared to Merlot or Pinot Noir even. And it's a product, cider and mead for that matter, are products way better suited to our region agriculturally than French hybrid grapes, you know. This is apple country, probably one of the best apple growing regions in the country next to the Northwest. So if we could get off French hybrids and move towards our heritage in apples, that would be a good thing for us to do in West Virginia. All of these apples were sourced locally and actually all from one farm in Monroe County, Morgan Orchard.
What is an elderberry?
An elderberry?
What is that?
That's a real, so it's, they grow all through Appalachia.
Oh, okay.
And in elderberries, it's a kind of a low shrub. They're pretty ripe in the late fall. And traditionally, a lot of people used to make elderberry wine in the fall, all through Appalachia. So we kind of took off on that tradition and steeped the elderberries in our cider. And actually,
that one now?
That's what we're gonna have now, actually.
Elderberry, I never heard of such a thing.
Beautiful.
It's a beautiful color. This is like a deep kind of burgundy rouge color. It's very similar to what you would expect to see in like an aged wine. That's what this color reminds me of, an aged red wine.
I like that.
People are really seeking craft hard cider now. We are the first one in West Virginia, and we're proud to be, but it's pretty shocking to me that we are the first one in the state. You know, there's really not many better places to be making hard cider, and it's truly part of our cultural heritage. It's part of our past, and we should be reviving it.
Since this story first aired back in 2015, Josh Bennett and Will Lewis have started selling their Hawk Knob cider in 11 towns across West Virginia, including Lewisburg, Charleston, Morgantown, and Elkins. And there's also a new cider business in West Virginia called Swill Dog Brewing, based in Pendleton County. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd.
Industry analysts say the cider business is booming across the country, including here in Appalachia. Sales have doubled during the past year in Virginia. Anywhere apples are grown, there's a decent chance you'll find a cidery nearby. And back in 2014, producer Lydia Wilson found one in Albemarle County, Virginia, and created this audio postcard.
This is Jupiter's Legacy, our toast to Monticello and Mr. Jefferson and colonial America. I'm Charlotte Shelton, and we are in the tasting room of Albemarle Cider Works in North Garden, Virginia. When we decided that one way to justify having 250 varieties of apple trees, which is a lunatic way to grow an orchard this day and age, I'll just tell you or anyone else, making cider was a natural. We were interested in the history of these varieties. A lot of them were used for cider. I think the future of cider depends on us establishing a market in which it's its own channel. It's not wine, it's not beer. It's distinct and special. These are dry ciders, all of them probably best with food. Our Jupiter's Legacy and the drier ones are fantastic with traditional American cuisine. Think of your Thanksgiving dinner, turkey and dressing. I mean, it's hard to find a wine that really does justice to turkey and dressing. Now, I claim no credit for creating the cider. My brother is the ciderist, Chuck.
In our first year in business, it's been kind of rewarding. As you know, cider is kind of being reintroduced to America. Cider died out for a number of reasons, and in the demise of cider, a lot of the orchards disappeared. A lot of the apple varieties almost disappeared or did completely disappear, so you just got to bring the orchards back.
Most of them don't know what we've got. Or if they think they know, they're thinking of something else. They're either thinking of fresh cider or juice. So I think something special about what we're doing is creating American cider. I refer to this as the American cider revival.
That story was produced by Lydia Wilson for the show With Good Reason, a program of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. The cidery we just heard about is Albemarle Cider Works, and it's one business in Virginia that's part of an upcoming week-long event called Cider Week, starting November 11th. Another cidery based out of Dougspur, Virginia, called Foggy Ridge, is even hosting a cider-making workshop. And there's another cider festival coming up in Asheville, North Carolina, on October 15th. You can check out the details on these events at our website at wvpublic.org. You may be wondering, how could this boom in hard apple cider change the apple orchards of tomorrow? How is the apple industry adapting to this trend? That's coming up in the second half of our show. I'm Jessica Lilly. You're listening to Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We wanted to send a warm shout-out to one of our newest and youngest listeners, 8-year-old Oscar Baumgartner in Johnson City, Tennessee. His dad, Tim, wrote us a note this week that says Oscar asked if he could listen to Inside Appalachia in bed. Oh, and since we're talking about apples on our show today, we asked about Oscar's favorite way to eat apples. And his dad says he loves apple butter and eats a peanut butter and apple butter sandwich almost every day. Now that sounds yummy. My son usually goes for the apples and honey or peanut butter and honey sandwiches, but we might just have to give that peanut butter and apple butter sandwich a try. Thanks for listening, Oscar, and thanks to your dad, Tim, for sharing Inside Appalachia with your family. Today we've been talking about apples. Certainly apples seem to suit our climate better than wine grapes, so hard apple cider could be one drink that seems to make sense for our region. Next, we're going to hear from our friends over at the Gravy Podcast, who recently produced an episode all about the changing apple industry and how cider is changing the apples that farmers are growing. Here's Mary Helen Montgomery with the story.
Two millennials walk up to a stranger's front porch in Mentone, Alabama. Pete's a big bearded guy. He's 27 years old and dressed in Carhartts and a hoodie. He's used to knocking on strangers' doors, but admits it usually goes better if his friend Eliza's with him. Luckily, Eliza's here today. She's 32, dressed in a red gingham shirt and work boots. And, as usual, she's exuding friendliness. An elderly man comes to the door. He's not sure what's going on, but seems delighted to see these two anyway. This is Eliza's smile in action.
Hello! I want to talk about your apple trees in the front yard.
Oh, what?
Eliza Greenman and Pete Halupka knock on strangers' doors like this all the time.
You know, if you've got a bunch of apple trees in your side yard, like, we're pulling over, we're going to knock on the door, and we're going to talk to you about what they are.
They call themselves fruit explorers. They hunt for fruits, mostly apples, growing wild or in people's yards. Pete and Eliza have actually stopped at this house before, Jimmy Wright's house. Last time, Wright's wife answered the door. It was late summer, apple season. Pete and Eliza asked if they could try the Wright's apples, and they liked what they tasted.
Did you hear Eliza say she came all the way from Virginia for your apple tree?
No.
I did. I drove 600 miles because I love your apple tree for cider. I think it's going to be next big thing.
By that, Eliza means that she and Pete think that the apple that grows here might be perfect for making hard cider. Eliza asks Wright if he wants to name the apple.
You got any ideas off the top of your head?
No.
We've been calling it Fetty or Fetty Wap.
That's okay. That's fine. That's fine.
That's Fetty Wap, as in the hip-hop artist who hit the top of the charts last year. Best known for his song Trap Queen, that's who Pete and Eliza chose to name the apple after. I'm like,
hey, what's up, hello? It was like half joke, but that apple is called Fetty Wap. We are passionate about taking like traditions and knowledge from older folks and making it accessible to everyone.
I really wanted to name it Beyonce, but I was ruled out because I was in a car full of guys.
It needs to be noted that I love Beyonce. Oh, there's also Ludacrisp, which is a variety that her apple breeder friend is talking about.
Today, Pete and Eliza have an apple to save. In front of Jimmy Wright's house, Eliza's up in the Fetty Wap tree.
Let me get a little higher.
She wedges in between limbs, clips branches, and tosses them down to Pete. What she's clipping is scion wood. It's the flexible new growth at the end of the limb. They'll cut some off so Eliza can take it home to Virginia to graft to existing rootstocks. Those root systems will grow the same kind of tree that's in the Wright's yard. You can plant apples from seed, too, instead of grafting. But if you plant from seed, you'll have no idea what kind of apple you'll get. That's because apple trees cross-pollinate, and it takes two kinds of trees to procreate. So if you want to grow a certain kind of apple, you have to do it through grafting, not by planting a seed.
This is like the best part of doing what we do is because we get to climb in trees for like, I mean, I climb in trees for a living almost.
Eliza's done clipping and jumps out of the tree. She and Pete sort through the stack of branches on the ground.
Okay. I'm going to say 38 to 41 sticks.
Each branch can graft onto more than one tree. That's because you only need one bud for each graft, and there are multiple buds on these cuttings. And this should be enough for Eliza to graft onto at least 100 rootstocks at home in Virginia. That means that in a few years, 100 more trees will be growing Fetty Wap. Pete and Eliza first met each other at a sustainable agriculture conference when Eliza was preaching to people about heirloom varieties of berries. Eliza lives in Northern Virginia, where she runs a nursery and teaches about fruit tree production. She's renovating an orchard where she'll grow apples and other fruits. Pete lives in Northern Alabama and runs a small fermentation business. His company, Harvest Roots, makes kombucha, kimchi, sauerkraut, and other kinds of fermented food. He's also in the process of getting an apple orchard up and running. As Eliza and Pete talked with each other, they realized they were both apple nuts who were passionate about biodiversity in the South. At one time, there were thousands of apple varieties in the South. But now, people only have access to a few kinds.
And that's where we are today, with 10 varieties of apples at the grocery store, tops.
When I look at a pile of apples in the store, like Granny Smith, next to Golden Delicious, next to Red Delicious, it's like a morgue to me. It's like so bureaucratic.
They started thinking, people don't give Southern apples enough credit. Most of the apples that are grown to eat fresh come from Washington, Michigan, and New York State. Southern apples have a different flavor. They're usually too tart for most people, and they get overlooked. But there are all kinds of other uses for Southern apples, besides just eating them fresh.
You can't really find an apple without a use. And at the least, it's going to make a great vinegar. Not to mention apple brandy, not to mention fresh juice, not to mention dumplings, not to mention fried pies.
And not to mention hard cider. Hard cider has been selling like crazy recently. Just in the last 2 years, sales in the U.S. have nearly doubled. Eliza has worked in the hard cider industry, and she sees a problem.
There's not enough apples. We're relying too much on English and French apple varieties that don't grow well here in the South.
They started thinking, what if we find a Southern apple that we would grow just for hard cider? Those same varieties that are too tart for a lunchbox could be perfect for hard cider.
American apple cultivars, they're traditionally known as high sugar, high acidity. And so in ciders these days, in this new resurgence, you're getting high sugar, high acidity ciders.
Which makes for a cider that tastes a lot like soda.
And what's really missing is that soft tannin without much acidity, but also has a lot of sugar.
Which is what they thought a southern apple might produce. A cider that has the same complexity as wine. In the 1800s, we lived in a country of farmers, and every community had apple trees. Hard cider was wildly popular back then, more popular than beer. But eventually, hard cider left the mainstream.
So here's what happened with cider in America.
Diane Flint is the owner of Foggy Ridge Cider in Southwest Virginia. Foggy Ridge was the first cidery to open in the South in modern times.
There were lots of factors that came together. The first and most powerful one was just the Industrial Revolution and the decline of farms. Because for the most part, people were not buying apples for cider. They were getting apples from their backyard, from their small farm orchard, you know, from a neighbor. So they were taking from what was around them. And as people moved to the cities, that went away.
Immigration affected cider production too.
But as you got more German and European immigrants who had a beer drinking culture, beer began to be brewed more than cider. It's faster, it's cheaper, the raw material is more portable, not as heavy as apples. And then, of course, when Prohibition rolled around, that was about it. The cider apple orchards were removed because many of the cider apples were not good eating apples. And then when Prohibition ended, it was easier and cheaper to make beer. The big beer companies came up, and that was the drink of choice.
Cider was eclipsed by beer, but it's also been brought back to life by the beer industry. As craft beer has made a comeback, people have become more aware of all craft beverages, including cider. But that's not all. People are actually drinking less beer now than they used to. So beer companies have started selling cider, and they've spent a lot of money on advertising. The popular brand Angry Orchard is made by the same company that makes Sam Adams beer.
Angry Orchard's ad budget year before last was $42 million. So that people talk about the resurgence of craft and drinking local beverages, and it's yeah. But $42 million goes a long way to making a market.
Even the craft ciders are benefiting. It's a good time to be in the craft cider industry, and Eliza and Pete want in. So Eliza and Pete came up with a plan. They wanted to try to find the next big cider apple, and they wanted to find it in the South. They decided to go on a road trip. Everywhere they stopped, they looked in people's yards, on the edge of forests.
Around here, all everywhere, 100 years ago, there were apple orchards. But what happened was we also have wild apples growing in our forests. So what you get is a wild meets domesticated hybrid that's growing along the forest edge. And so not only were we looking for old known varieties, but we were looking for new awesome stuff.
But they weren't just looking for an apple on their road trip. They wanted to find stories about southern apples too, from the people who knew the very most, the veteran apple growers in the South, many of whom are in their 80s and 90s.
We've been listening to a story by Mary Helen Montgomery with the Gravy Podcast. Coming up, fruit explorers of the past and present, including a visit with a retired fruit explorer who saved many of Alabama's old apples. That's ahead. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. This time of year, apples are just about everywhere in Appalachia. Next, we'll hear from two folks with an unusual hobby. They're on a quest to find old heirloom apple trees. Let's pick it back up with Mary Helen Montgomery with her story.
If you ride in a car with Pete or Eliza, you'll notice that they're always on the hunt. They'll point out trees and bushes on the side of the road as you drive by, even if you're on the interstate going 70.
fruit cheese in general, if you start recognizing their form and you get really excited about it, the landscape just lights up. It used to be, for me, I'd look for skate spots, but now I look for fruit trees.
Pete and Eliza are actually part of a long history of American plant hunters. The first known professional plant hunter in America was John Bartram. In the early 1700s, he and his sons explored the American South, collecting plants for his nursery. Even Thomas Jefferson did some plant hunting. He went to Italy to find a new kind of rice that could grow in dry soil. By the mid-1800s, the U.S. government still saw a need for this kind of work. We needed more biodiversity in our agriculture, for food security. In case there was a blight of some kind, you needed other varietals of fruits and vegetables as backups. And they figured new agriculture would be good for the economy and good for health.
They sent fruit explorers all over the world.
To China for tea leaves, to Turkestan for melons.
Because the USDA knew that if they didn't get an alfalfa hardy enough to grow in South Dakota, that there wasn't going to be any meat, there wasn't going to be any nitrogen in the soil. So they sent a USDA explorer to Siberia to find alfalfa strains.
These explorers,
these sort of like famous ragged men,
introduced tons of new plants to American soil. And now, about a century later, Pete and Eliza still see the need for this kind of work, for fruit exploring. Because now we grow a very small number of plant species on a massive scale. Pete and Eliza belong to the North American Fruit Explorers, a group with about 3,000 members. Today, fruit explorers don't necessarily go to exotic lands around the globe. Instead, they're looking for what's already growing in the landscape. When Eliza finds an interesting apple, it can be downright thrilling.
Whatever the feeling is, it's probably the exact same of just like finding like King Tut's treasure or something, you know. It's the same for me and finding these lost apple varieties.
When Eliza finds an old apple tree she's looking for, she gets giddy. If she's with a friend, she'll pose for a picture, hugging the branches. That's actually how they found the Fediwap. At the very end of their road trip, practically in Pete's backyard in Mentone, Alabama.
We searched all over the South, and what do you know, right under our noses here, there's this apple that I think is amazing. It's a bittersweet, which means that it's got soft tannins. A tannin is like what dries your mouth out if you eat like an acorn or something. And it doesn't have any acidity.
They picked lots of the Fediwap apples. Pete took them home and pressed them into cider. It would take months to ferment. Months before he could taste it, to see if the Fediwap cider is as good as they hoped it would be. The more Eliza and Pete can learn about the old apples, the better chance they'll have of growing them well, making good cider from them, and telling other people about them. That's where some of these elders come in. There was another purpose to their road trip, too, beyond the search for the cider apple, and that was visiting some of the South's best apple growers. They went to Virginia.
And visited Albemarle Cider Works, where we met Tom Burford, who is a seventh-generation orchardist.
In North Carolina, they visited Lee Calhoun, a man who is revered among Southern apple growers. He's responsible for researching hundreds of heirloom varieties. He literally wrote the book on old Southern apples. Another one of the people Eliza and Pete visited on the road trip was Joyce Neighbors. She's 88 now. Joyce and Pete both live in Alabama, and Pete considers her a mentor. He likes to drop by when he can, so that he can soak in some of the knowledge she spent so long learning. I went with him to visit her.
Hey, stranger.
How you doing?
I'm doing all right.
Come on in.
Joyce moves across her living room with a walker. She sits in a big cushioned chair with a quilt draped over the back. She leans back and gets comfortable. We're here to talk about heirloom apples in Alabama, the kind that Joyce spent so many years growing in her backyard orchard.
I guess I'm the one that started most of those Southern apple in Alabama.
When Joyce says she started the old Southern apples here, this is what she means. A long time ago, at least 100 years ago, it was very common to grow apples in your yard, and there were all different kinds.
Southern apples are special because during the hard times a long time ago, that's the only thing people had to eat. It was a subsistence food. They had to have it to survive.
They got us through hard times.
Yes, I sure did. The old timers didn't fool with trees. It wasn't any good.
When you say the old timers, who are you talking about? Like your grandparents?
Maybe my great grandparents back around 1900 to 1930s.
Joyce was interested in old apples, though, So when she says she started old apples in Alabama, she means she brought many of them back to life.
I just got excited about it. It might be in my family history because my grandfather Whitley was a big orchardist.
So in the 1980s, she got plugged in with a group of orchardists in the South who were bringing back heirloom apples, including Lee Calhoun. Remember the one who wrote the book on old Southern apples? Calhoun gave Joyce a mission.
He said, well, I'm going to make you responsible for Alabama.
The whole state.
Yeah, yes.
Joyce had an orchard in her backyard, and just like Pete and Eliza, she would follow crazy leads to hunt for apples. And when she would find an exciting apple, she would add it to her orchard. Granny Neighbors, Red Rebel, Red Hackworth.
In its heyday, it had about 200 trees in it. And when it was in full bloom on a sunny day, it was a real pretty place.
Joyce's orchard is in her backyard, a very short walk from the house. But it's hard for her to get around now. She hasn't even seen her apple trees in about 5 years. Pete wants to check it out while he's here, though, and let Joyce know how it's doing. Pete and I go outside. The orchard is so overgrown that I don't even realize we're standing in the middle of it. There are trees all around us, but they're covered in shrubs.
It's just like so poetic to me that all the trees that she, that are so local to her and that she found are the ones that do so well.
Yeah.
They're healthy. You know, they're not going anywhere.
But they are overgrown, uncared for. So many years of work covered in privet. It seems like such a heartbreak. But Pete tells me it's not.
Before I understood that everything was preserved in it, I would always get pretty sad in here. But, you know, I understand that every variety, I've made sure that, and many other people have made sure that everything in here is not a one-off and that someone has it.
Everything that Joyce has grown has been passed on, grafted onto apple trees around the South. Back in Mentone, Alabama, we're on Pete's land, where pigs are chewing on vegetable scraps. They're preparing the soil in Pete's new orchard. His orchard could not look more different from Joyce's. He just planted it. I don't notice the trees here either, but for a different reason. At this point, they're just sticks poking out of the mud.
To me, it looks kind of like mud in one tree. What do you see?
I can see a mature orchard, anywhere from green to red, apples hanging off of a tree, tree after tree.
But it will be about 5 more years until the orchard looks like what Pete's describing. Pete and I leave the orchard in his backyard and go into his house. He has something important to do inside today.
This is our little ferment room.
Today, Pete is bottling hard cider.
This is the first cider to be made with Fetty Wap.
After Pete and Eliza found Fetty Wap, Pete pressed the apples, and he let them ferment in the open air. Then the juice went into a big jug with an airlock.
And that's when the alcohol production begins.
Today, Pete's going to transfer the big jug of cider into small bottles.
Super DIY homebrew. Just have a rubber tube and I'm siphoning out of a apple juice jug.
The really exciting part of today, though, is that we get to taste the cider. This batch is actually a blend of Fetty Wap and another wild apple that Pete found in Birmingham. Pete pours us a glass.
This sort of smells like juniper berries and caramel, but it's definitely time to taste it. So it definitely like puckers my tongue.
I take a sip too. It's really tart. I'm not used to this taste, and it's kind of hard to drink. And even though I don't want more than a sip or two, I understand the appeal of this kind of cider. The taste is much more complex than the big brand hard ciders on the market. You don't get the whole picture the first time it hits your tongue. The flavor keeps evolving in your mouth. Pete thinks the cider will mellow out over time. He also thinks Fetty Wap might be better paired with an apple that's sweeter than the one he used in this cider. But he still has faith in this apple. The cider recipe just needs to be refined. Will Fetty Wap really be the next great cider apple? Could be. But Diane Flint at Foggy Ridge Cider thinks it would be unlikely to stumble on a great cider apple that nobody knows about yet.
The best cider apples in the world are known, are likely known. And the chance of finding a wild apple is, you know, one in hundreds of, that would be better than Hughes Crab or Yarlington Mill or Dabinet or Ashmead's Kernel or Harrison. It's just, I'm not going to live long enough for that. And apple enthusiasts who are chasing that sort of thing down may like the chase and the sense of adventure. But if your goal is to make wonderful cider, we know scores of apples that will do that today.
Diane does think there's value in hunting apples in order to connect a place in its past. For Pete and Eliza, the adventure and the business are intertwined. They do think Fetty Wap will make a great cider, but they know the apple stands for a lot more than that. To them, Fetty Wap means adventure, a connection across generations, a fight against monoculture. Fetty Wap didn't come with a story, but Pete and Eliza have given it one.
Mary Helen Montgomery is a radio producer based in Chattanooga, Tennessee. That story was produced for the Gravy Podcast, a production of the Southern Foodways Alliance. Appalachian foodies may have seen or heard about a new cookbook that's been getting a lot of buzz lately. It's called Vittles, and a few of the recipes in the book references a pie crust by Emily Hilliard. Emily is the state folklorist in West Virginia, but she's also a great baker. And since we're talking about apples on today's show, we wanted to chat with her a little bit about her thoughts and tips on making apple pies. Emily, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
You have a blog. It's called Nothing in the House. It's a pie blog. Where did you get the name Nothing in the House?
Well, that came from a book on the study of American folklore. And back in the day when I was not yet a folklorist, but I must have had an inkling. and it's a type of pie often called desperation pies that were popular during the Great Depression and in rural places across the U.S., I would say mostly the Midwest, Appalachia, and the frontier. And those pies were basically made with whatever ingredients you had on hand. So a classic example is vinegar pie or vinegar chest pie. So that's basically using vinegar in place of where there might be lemon. Then basically sugar, flour, salt, maybe some other seasonings, butter, always butter.
So is that kind of your style, as looking at lots of things that you might regularly find in the cupboard and sort of making do with that? Is that in getting creative with it?
Yeah, I think that's my personal style. think then from sort of a cultural perspective, that's the type of baking that really interests me. It's not really the professional, I mean, that is an interest, but it's not really the fancy cooking or baking. It's what our home cooks making in different places across the country, in different situations, different eras. What are people eating in their daily lives?
And your blog, your blog posts usually have different recipes. That's what it's about, and you talk about it. And the latest blog post was Nearly Fall Tart with Goat Cheese and Almond Shortbread and an almond shortbread crust. It looked really beautiful and delicious, I have to say.
Thanks.
A big fruit fan. And it looked like a really beautiful fruit salad sort of sitting on top of this really nice crust on the bottom. It was so well presented. It looked really like a picture, really. but can you tell us the difference? I mean, it's still called a pie blog, but it's a tart that's featured in your latest entry. What's the difference between a pie and a tart?
I think really at the basic level, it is the tradition it's coming out of. So I think of tarts as more French or English. And most tarts are using a short crust pastry, which is kind of a cookie crust or a crumble or crumbly crust that you form together. So that, for instance, had almonds in the short crust, as opposed to a pie crust, which is more of a pastry that has laminated, so you're getting the flakes of butter or lard or whatever fat you like to use in your pie crust. And that's more of, I'd say at this point, it's an American tradition.
Mm.
I use the Duncan Hines pie crust, I think is what it's called.
Whatever works.
I was looking at the tart, though, and I saw it, and I thought, well, hey, this I might be able to do this, but not necessarily the homemade crust. But, you know, putting the beautiful fruit in it and things, my experience with baking pies is the can of pumpkin pie filling, mm-hmm. open it up, following the directions, good to go. And I'm, it's a huge hit at Thanksgiving. Yeah, so.
And I am... No, you know, I use canned pumpkin. I will not shy away from that.
Okay.
I think there are some instances where if you're using real pumpkin, I prefer to use real squash, unless you're using a very good pie pumpkin. I think you might as well use the canned pumpkin.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. That makes me feel a lot better, especially considering that your pie crust is the one that's featured throughout this cookbook by Ronnie Lundy. Tell us more about this crust. What's special? What's different about this one and the others?
Sure. Well, I think that there are many great pie crusts out there, and I am not really saying that mine is special or the best. You know, different people have different tastes. I think the best crust that I ever had was a lard and butter crust. So he's using both both fats, and the butter provides the flakiness, or the butter provides the flavor, and the lard gives the flakiness. So that was incredible. But this is the standard pie crust that I use for basic pies, and it was given to me by a rhubarb farmer at the Ann Arbor, Michigan Farmers Market when I had graduated from college. And it's really just with a few adaptations, it's become what I've used. And it's an all-butter crust. It has a lot of butter. It has flour, sugar, salt, apple cider vinegar, and egg. And the apple cider vinegar helps with the... you don't want these long strands of gluten to form. You don't want to work the dough too much with a pie crust as opposed to how you would knead with a bread dough where you want gluten to form. And with pie crust, you want to make sure that there are still large chunks of butter because that's really what is providing your flakiness. So you don't want to work the dough too much, and the cold vinegar really helps with that. And you want to make sure everything basically remains cold. So it's kind of hard to do sometimes in, you know, if your kitchen doesn't have air conditioning. I struggle with some melty pie crust in the heat of summer. But I think really what this crust is a versatile go-to recipe.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's featured throughout this cookbook, and it's a really nice looking cookbook. I mean, it's a hardcover, and there's such beautiful pictures in here. And then there's a picture of you here in the back too. You're rolling out the dough here. It's such a great picture of you. I love that picture.
Yeah. So those photos were taken by Johnny Autry, who works with his wife Charlotte to do. She does the styling, and they are just incredible all over Vittles. And they were really great to work with, too.
Your pie crust in this cookbook is sort of like saying it's featured throughout. It's not just one. So it's saying, and I think you mentioned this before, you can use your favorite or you can use the standard, which is Miss Emily's, and you can refer to hers on page 306.
Well, I think that's very nice of you to say. And it's also, you know, very kind of Ronnie to include me, but I think it is a standard go-to, but I also welcome people using any crust of their own family tradition or their preference, so I don't have to be the go-to.
Well, and you also have an article featured in a magazine called SIFT, Living, Breathing, Baking, and this article talks about the anthropology of pie. Tell us a little bit about that, if you can.
Yeah, so that is a King Arthur Flour magazine that came out, I think, last fall. And they asked me to write basically a 1,000-word article on the anthropology of pie, which I realized is a book. but I sort of got through the basics in this article and kind of presenting the scope of the history of pie in the U.S. and why do we say things like American is apple pie, that sort of thing. So some of the themes that I think I'm exploring there are the idea that pie has these two kind of disparate entities. There's the hard crust, and that is kind of this I think of it as you need to have some sort of skill or knowledge to do that well. And then the filling, which is loose and you can throw whatever you want in.
Yeah, I think I can handle that part.
Yeah, like you were saying. Yeah. So in a way, pie is this balance between these two opposites. You want the crust to be crisp and flaky, but then you want the filling to be gooey and you don't want the crust to get too, you know, sopping wet with the filling. So it's really this exercise in balance. And I'm kind of exploring that on a cultural level and talking about how pie is really something that values rural places over urban places traditionally. Mm. It's rural food. And that goes back to the nothing in the house and depression pies, desperation pies. It's something that people could make to extend things longer. Like if they're making savory pies, meat's about to go bad or meat doesn't taste that good. You throw it with some other things, maybe some apples and some raisins and mincemeat pie, and it's delicious. And it just extends things further. And pie also demands you to sit down with other people. It's not like a cupcake that is your personal party. It is a communal dish. So you have to sit down to eat it. It's not something you can eat on the go. It's best shared, people sitting around it. Mm. So that's really one of the things I like the most about pie. It demands social gathering.
Yeah, which seems really important nowadays with social media and the way that we interact so often digitally. I never thought about it that way, but if you're right. When you have a pie, you do have to sort of sit down and enjoy it and interact with other folks. Emily says she first fell in love with pie making when she discovered this social connection. She had just graduated college and had just found wild mulberry trees and wild black raspberry bushes around Ann Arbor, Michigan, where she was living.
All my gal friends got together and we picked berries and we made pies together this summer.
Oh, wow.
And it was sort of this post-college, what are we going to do with our lives? We don't know. Let's make pies instead. So that was
really...
Because
that way you can keep socializing, right? You have to.
Yeah, keep your hands busy, keep your mind off things.
Yeah.
So that was really how it started. And then it just sort of evolved from there. The blog came about because one of my friends who I was baking with said, when I moved away, let's start this blog and we can stay in touch through the pies we're baking. So that's really how it started. And then as I got more interested in traditional American foodways and folklore, then it took on this cultural element. So it's evolved sort of as I've evolved as an adult in the world.
With your ingredients, where do you usually find them, especially for your apple pie? Where do you find those ingredients?
Yeah, so for apple pie, I really prefer to go to an orchard or get them directly from someone who's growing heirloom apples. I'd say my favorite baking apple is the Northern Spy. And that's just what I grew up with. And there's a saying, spies are for pies. It's an heirloom variety. It's very tart. And I think that's really what you want for a good pie. You want a tart apple. Mm. Or you want a combination of tart and sweet. You know, if you have to get it at the grocery store, I would say go with the tartest apple you probably can find, which may be a Granny Smith. But at the farmer's market or from an orchard, you could look for Northern Spies, Arkansas Black, Gravenstein, Wine Sap in West Virginia. The Grimes Golden is a variety that was developed here, and I hear a lot of people talking about the Grimes Golden being their favorite. So look for those old heirloom varieties that may not be cosmetically perfect but have really good flavor.
I have to ask you, too, you know, in a world where we're constantly hearing eat healthy, cut back on sugar, cut back on breads. Do you ever feel like it's challenging to be a baker and have this passion for pies nowadays with that? Or do you kind of struggle with that on how to stay healthy with it? Or
yeah, I do think that's a concern. You know, there's a study that just came out that we have been downplaying the toll that sugar takes on you. And I do think about that a lot. I basically, in every recipe that I encounter, I reduce the sugar because I find things that are way too sweet. And my purpose in, you know, in baking something, especially with fruit, is to really make that fruit flavor stand out, and sometimes the sugar can really mask that. So I reduce sugar, I think about moderation, and I also think about just things that are handmade. I think if you're using good ingredients and you're putting care and love into your baking, then there's an element of health to that too. That's comfort and connection. And it's probably going to be a lot better than a pie from the store or processed baked good. So moderation, love, reducing sugar. That's kind of my motto for that.
Yeah, it's good advice, I think. What about advice for folks like myself who might be a little intimidated by this, you know, homemade crust pie baking thing? Any words of encouragement for those folks who might be intimidated by it?
Sure. Well, first of all, I would say no shame. There's no shame in you know, buying a crust, in using canned filling. If that's what you have to do, if that's the way you like it, do that. I also think if you do want to try to tackle homemade crust, practice. Practice makes perfect. It might not work the first time, but in the end, you're probably going to end up with something that's pretty good to eat. So even if it doesn't look pretty or it falls apart, it's probably going to be good.
Just go for
still.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Emily Hilliard, the West Virginia State folklorist, also the author of a blog called Nothing in the House, a pie blog. She's also featured in the latest cookbook by Ronnie Lundy, and you can find her in lots of articles all over talking about baking and pies, and also on Instagram. What's your handle there?
The House Pie.
The House Pie. Mm-hmm. Yes. Emily, thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
You can see photos from some of Emily's pies and that gorgeous fig and goat cheese tart on our website at wvpublic.org. Well, that's our show about apples today. Thanks for listening. You know, I had no idea there were so many different types of apples. I can remember hearing about John Chapman as a kid. You know, Johnny Appleseed, the guy who traveled from Massachusetts planting apples across the country. The thing is that when you plant apple trees from seeds, the fruit's not fit for eating, but it is perfect for making hard apple cider, apparently. The physical evidence of the legendary nurseryman is said to be in Ohio. The Golden Delicious, actually, that grows right here in West Virginia, is also said to have been brought here by Johnny Appleseed. Just think, Napa Valley out in the western part of the U.S. has aged grape vineyards that are great for wines. And, you know, we're looking for economic opportunities, and we've said it before, farming isn't easy. But perhaps it could be part of our future as we continue to find ways to replant our agricultural roots to diversify our economy. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the West Virginia Humanities Council and the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Music in today's show was provided by the Hillbilly Gypsies, the Western Avenue String Band, Anna and Elizabeth, Dog and Gun, Ben Townsend, and Andy Agnew Jr. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Xander Alloy. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at @InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.